Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers, your favorite professor here. American Civil War episodes are among the most popular and heavily downloaded in history podcasts. And perhaps second only to World War II, the American Civil War also leads Google history searches in terms of numbers and frequency. One of the most Googled Civil War topics during the last few months has been the Black Confederate soldiers story and myth. We wanted to talk about it on this show, so naturally we contacted the most distinguished expert on this topic, Kevin Levin, whose Searching for Black Confederates, the Civil War's Most Persistent Myth, addresses this history comprehensively. We asked him to come on the show, and fortunately he said yes. But before I interview Mr. Levin, I want to alert all of you Buzzkillers who support us on Patreon that we will be giving away a copy of Searching for Black Confederates to the first Patreon Buzzkiller who emails us at info@professorbuzzkill.com and asks for it. It's one of the most important recent books on Civil War history and memory, and you'll love it. Naturally, it's also on the Buzzkill bookshelf at professorbuzzkill.com for those of you who want to buy a copy. So, here we go. All right, Buzzkillers, we have Kevin Levin on the line, on the internets now. We're going to talk about his famous book now famous, hasn't even been out a year, and it's already selling like crazy and being reviewed wonderfully, called Searching for Black Confederates, the Civil War's Most Persistent Myth. Thank you for being on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Can you tell us a little bit about this Black Confederate soldiers myth for people who don't know about it?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to sort of get at this is if you were just simply to go to the internet right now and in your preferred search engine type in, you know, the words Black Confederate or Black Confederates, and you will get, you know, hundreds if not thousands of results. Right. And many of these websites, you know, basically purport to tell the story of anywhere between 500 and 100,000 so-called Black Confederate soldiers. Essentially, it's the argument that the Confederacy recruited thousands, potentially thousands of enslaved men, even free blacks, to fight as soldiers in integrated regiments throughout the entire war. And [S2] Wow. [S1] And like I said, this is a myth that lives overwhelmingly on the internet today.
Right. Okay. So is it kind of then a new myth? We'll sort of get to this after the sponsorship break, but is it a 20th century myth or a 19th century myth?
Yeah, so it's evolved out of the mid-19th century, but it sort of its modern version dates to the mid to the late 1970s, and you know, there are a number of reasons why that was the case.
Okay, and like I say, we'll that's sort of our bang for the buck thing that listeners are going to get after the sponsorship break. Yeah. Can you tell us if this is a myth and it's not true? We see these pictures. You say do a Google search. We see pictures of African Americans in what look like uniform or uniform-like clothing, holding arms, guns or knives. What are those African Americans doing in next to Confederate soldiers, if you will?
Yeah, I think it speaks to many of the problems as to why this myth has become so pervasive, and that is that these primary sources, you know, exist online and usually in many cases are posted by people who are not capable of properly interpreting these primary sources. And so seeing a man in uniform, sometimes sitting next to or standing next to a white officer, certainly looks like a Black Confederate soldier. So it was not uncommon for body servants, I call camp slaves in the book, to be uniformed by their masters when they were brought into the army. In some cases, these men were able to purchase parts of uniforms as a result of the money they earned during free time in camp. And then after the war, many of these men did return to Confederate veterans reunions for a number of reasons. And many of them wore parts of their old uniforms. And so those photographs are not really sort of photographs of soldiers. They are photographs of former body servants, former camp slaves, in some cases decades after the war, attending these Confederate reunions.
So there are African Americans in the army in the broadest sense, that they're these body servants, as you say, or camp slaves.
Oh, absolutely. I think, and this was one of the, for me, it was a revelation in terms of doing the research, because I think most of us, when we imagine in our head what a Confederate army looked like, say on the march, you know, what did 75,000 men look like? I think overwhelmingly we imagine an army of white men. But I think, you know, if we were to look specifically, for example, at Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia in the summer of 1863, marching north, culminating what we know as the Battle of Gettysburg, again, numbering somewhere around 75,000 men, there may have been as many as 10 to 12,000 enslaved men with that army. And so we're essentially talking about armies of slaves. And they would have performed any number of functions throughout the war. I mentioned in just a minute ago the body servants that that Confederate officers brought with them as their own personal servants. But right from the very beginning of the war, the Confederacy mobilized tens of thousands of enslaved men to do all kinds of support roles for the military, to free up as many military-aged white men as possible to shoulder a rifle in the army. So the Confederacy did this out of necessity, and you would have found, for example, thousands of enslaved men, working construction sites, constructing earthworks in various parts of the Confederacy. They would have been responsible for building and repairing rail lines. They would have worked at, you know, places like Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond, Virginia, manufacturing war material for the armies. So, you know, when Alexander Stevens, the vice president, talked about in early 1861 of slavery being the cornerstone of the Confederacy, I think when we look at the ways in which the Confederacy mobilized enslaved men specifically for the military, it really drives that point home. These armies could not have functioned without the support of enslaved men.
And by the way, we should remind buzzkillers, Alexander Stevens is the vice president of the Confederacy, not the vice president of the United States. So they have all these roles, but they're all behind the lines. Presumably on the Union side, that means there are a lot of ordinary army people that are doing the same roles but can't fight. So the Confederacy is freed up in a way.
That's right.
To put as many fighters as possible on the front lines.
Oh, that's absolutely, that's right. I mean, these armies, the logistical support that these armies need to march, to camp, and even to engage in battle efficiently, that takes itself thousands of men. And, you know, because of the difference in population between the North and the South, the Confederacy is obviously forced to take advantage of its enslaved population. So they would have seen this, I mean, they would have seen it as an advantage to the North. Mm-hmm. They could take advantage of thousands of what they believed to be loyal slaves toiling for the Confederate war effort.
So you mentioned body servants, which would be sort of basically butlers or people who took care of clothing and maybe food and other things for officers. What else did the camp slaves do?
Yeah, anything that an officer needed for him to be able to carry out his responsibilities as an officer. So, as you mentioned, cooking, cleaning, tending horses, you know, preparing the officer's camp for a long march, carrying things, you know, to various places. They would have served as messengers with other parts of the military, also with their own families back home. So these body servants, and that's, I think this is an important point, these body servants or camp slaves existed outside of the Confederate military structure. They were obviously legally tied to their masters. So think of this as the master-slave relationship plucked from the plantation setting and placed in a military setting. That's what we're talking about here. This is an extension of that relationship.
Okay, is it mainly officers who have these camp slaves, or do some enlisted men have them?
Overwhelmingly officers, but not entirely. In fact, the most famous photograph, which I think we'll get to, the one of Silas and Andrew Chandler, Silas was an enlisted man at the very beginning of the war. So there are some examples of privates bringing body servants into the military, but overwhelmingly It's Confederate officers. And, you know, it's not just that they're bringing them in out of necessity because they need their assistance. It's also a sign of their social status as members of the slaveholding class.
May I ask you about these photographs? There seem to be, you know, a half a dozen or so of them. And the first of all, they seem to be very staged. Most of them are in a portrait studio. How do they come about? Is this the beginning of the war? Is this before the war started? Well,
I think overwhelmingly most of them are taken at the beginning of the war.
Right.
They are in some cases, we know, probably on their way from home to actual enlistment or actually joining their respective regiments. And they would have taken these photographs to demonstrate their own sense of Southern honor as slaveholders.
Right.
They would have taken them to sort of remind their families of what they're about to get into, right? I mean, they're defending their families, they're defending their communities. And mm-hmm. so these photographs are a very tangible reminder of that. And it's also, I think, a reminder of the sort of central role of slavery to the Confederacy, that even in the war itself, right from the beginning, these men, these officers see slavery as a strength, not as a potential weakness, which ultimately I think in many cases it becomes, because of course, as I discuss in the book, you know, there are plenty of stories of these body servants running off to embrace their freedom. And that becomes, and that's a very difficult thing for Confederate officers to deal with, because they see in a way, by the middle of the war, slavery crumbling around them.
There's also, it seems to be a good deal of talk about how loyal some of these camp slaves are to their masters in terms of taking care of them, doing a good job behind the lines, and even retrieving them from the body, from the battlefield, if they've been wounded or killed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you read the letters and diaries from these officers, these Confederate officers, they go out of their way to highlight what they see as loyal behavior,
right?
And they exaggerate it, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that can be sort of framed as the behavior or a reflection of a loyal slave, you see it in their letters and diaries. And that's true even after the war, as former soldiers, former officers are remembering their former body servants. They're still exaggerating this, this behavior during the war, and especially in cases where the body servant still exhibits what they perceive, even decades after the war, as loyal behavior. It's a reflection of their loyalty at one point to the Confederacy, to their master, and then decades after the war, even a kind of loyalty to the emerging Jim Crow South. And that, of course, is a central component of the whole lost cause narrative that emerges after the war. This idea that the war wasn't about, that the Confederates weren't fighting to preserve the institution of slavery, because from the beginning of the war to the end, their slaves remained loyal, and only because of the evil Yankee hordes. Mm-hmm. Think Sherman through Georgia in 64, only because of the invaders was their peaceful civilization upended.
So is there any point at which, say the Sherman marched through Georgia, or times when the Confederacy is really up against it and losing, when camp slaves are dragooned into battle just because, you know, at the end of the war, because they have to have somebody to fire weapons? Did it ever happen?
Yeah, I think throughout the war it happens.
I think this is
one of the most misunderstood aspects of this, of the history of the relationship between body servants, camp slaves, and their officers. Because if you imagine thousands of these men, sort of in the army itself, and that includes the battlefield, that includes body servants and other impressed slaves having to risk their own lives bring equipment onto the battlefield, food to their officers and other men. And so quite often you find examples where the sort of the sweep of battle or the flow of battle places these men in harm's way. And there are plenty of accounts of these men picking up rifles and shooting at Yankees.
Right.
And again, that's another, to get back to your original, your previous point, that's another example of where Confederates exaggerate this perceived loyal behavior. But in this case, what's really interesting, and I write about this in the book, they're ambivalent about it. They're ambivalent about having to write about what appears to be brave behavior on the battlefield. Right. Because remember, the battlefield is a place for white Southern men to demonstrate their bravery and reinforce the whole Southern hierarchy.
Right.
And to see slaves appear to be acting brave threatens to flatten that that hierarchy. It threatens to destroy that hierarchy. So when you read their accounts, on the one hand, they reference the behavior of their slaves on the battlefield, but they don't lose the opportunity. They don't miss the opportunity, say, if they run off the battlefield in the face of bullets or artillery. They also include stories of their slaves running off and fleeing, right? Because in a way that allows them to reset the hierarchy, to reset their own belief system.
Right. It's the superior white Confederate who's able to fight for the glory of the South rather than the inferior black.
Yeah. And that's also, that's absolutely right. And I think it's also the reason why in 1864, the whole debate about whether or not to enlist slaves as soldiers is so divisive, because of course, if you enlist slaves as soldiers in the Confederate Army, for many of these men, you know, it raises the question of, well, what are we fighting for?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
If slaves make good soldiers, as one Confederate officer put it, then our cause is ruined, right? What do we have to fight for?
So you mean in 1864, things are going bad enough for the Confederacy that they actually start talking about enlisting black men?
Oh, yeah.
As fighters?
This debate takes place throughout the Confederacy, and you can read literally thousands of editorials in newspapers back and forth debating this issue. They debate it obviously in Richmond, Virginia, mm-hmm. And they debate it even in the armies itself. So individual regiments would have, in many cases, issued their own sort of collective view as to whether or not to approve this policy. And you know, the fact that the Confederacy doesn't approve it, barely approves this policy, I think March 13th of 1865, gives you a sense of just how controversial this is, because of course, within weeks, the Confederacy is, you know, armies are surrendering, beginning with Lee's army at Appomattox on April 9th. And so the fact that this doesn't happen earlier does give you a sense of how closely bound they are to the institution of slavery. And so the war ends for the Confederacy as a white man's war.
Right. So we need to be clear with buzzkillers then that it isn't true that a lot of African American men go off and volunteer for the army, even freed the Confederate Army, or it is only a case of absolute dire necessity that some Confederates dragoon their body slaves into fighting.
Well, I want to be very clear here because I think the language really matters,
right.
And that is, no one considers in the Confederacy, no one considers body servants or impressed slaves to be doing what white soldiers are doing.
Okay, right?
They see them clearly as enslaved men, right? Mm-hmm. They have the same legal status as they did before the war.
Right.
It is true, however, I think this is an important point to make, that the very beginning of the war, there is a relatively small free black population in the Southern states, and some of them do volunteer their services to the Confederacy. Places like Petersburg, Virginia, New Orleans, they're rejected.
Okay.
By the Confederacy. And they're rejected because, of course, the Confederacy has no interest in recruiting blacks as soldiers. Why they would have done so, of course, could be for many reasons. Some of these free African Americans, have their own wealth to worry about,
sure.
Their own sort of place in their community. What is this going to mean under a new government, under the Confederacy? So out of their own self-preservation, it's likely that they thought that by volunteering, they would have sort of shored up their own standing, you know, in their local communities. But throughout the war, they're rejected. In fact, what's even interesting here is that Northern newspapers at different times during the war do report seeing African Americans in the Confederate ranks performing as soldiers.
Right.
What's interesting, of course, for people who like to sort of throw this out today as evidence of black soldiers, is that you can never find, of course, Confederate newspapers
reporting this. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And Confederates, when they read these newspapers or when they hear about these reports, they are very vocal about rejecting them. They don't want anyone to be under the illusion that they are recruiting blacks as soldiers in the army. They see this as sort of an insult to the cause itself.
Well, it's about time for us to take a sponsorship break, and I think after we come back, I'd like to talk about what I find actually the most interesting part of this issue, and that is what happens after the war and how this myth eventually develops. So Buzzkillers will be back in a moment. Hi there, Buzzkillers. You know that knowledge is power. That's why I'm so powerful. But thanks to the great Courses Plus, we can get to tap into this power with just one click. With the great Courses Plus streaming service, you can unlock unlimited access to objective, to reliable, to fascinating information on virtually any subject. With over 4,000 five-star reviews on the Great Courses Plus, you're guaranteed to find compelling content about almost anything you want to learn more about. Now, to go along with this episode, I recommend their course, A New History of the American South. It's fantastic. Dr. Ed Ayers is one of the greatest historians on the American South. He's one of the most important researchers in that field. But also, he's very good because he's a part of the Backstory History podcast at the University of Virginia, and he's just an amazing historian. Right? He gives you an extensive exploration of the story and the legacy of the South and its role in shaping U.S. history, including the Civil War. Now, tap into this power of knowledge. Join me, thousands of other listeners, and sign up for the Great Courses Plus. Why? Because you should, because knowledge is power, but also because they're giving you, Buzzkillers, my listeners, a free month trial of unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library. Now, here's what you do. Start your free month now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. That's right, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Do it after this episode's over, Buzzkillers, and you will get that power that is knowledge. Okay, we're back with Kevin Levin, Searching for Black Confederates, the Civil War's Most Persistent Myth. This is such a fascinating book in so many ways, and because I think one of the fascinating things about history myths is not so much whether they're, you know, fictional or nonfiction, whether they're true or not. We sort of addressed that in the first half of the show. But how these myths build in subsequent decades and even in subsequent centuries. So let's start off with what happens after the war. Most Buzzkillers have heard our shows, for instance, on the Lost Cause and on Reconstruction, so they know a little bit about that. But how does this happen afterwards?
Yeah, what happens? That's probably enough to understand what happens in this context.
Right.
With the rise of the Lost Cause, you know, I think one of the most important threads in that narrative is the belief that their slaves remain loyal. And so within that loyal slave umbrella, you know, former body servants would have been particularly important for former Confederate veterans to highlight, because of course, you know, regardless of whether they ran off for their freedom in certain numbers, there were still body servants in Lee's army at the end of the war at Appomattox,
right,
and in other armies,
right,
when they surrendered in the spring of 1865. So Confederate veterans would have highlighted them in their reminiscences, and especially in their Confederate veterans activities after the war, and most specifically when it comes to reunions. You find, and we touched on this earlier, you find body servants, and there are a small number that attend, in some cases, over 10 reunions. And they were welcomed with open arms by former Confederates. And they were also welcomed with open arms by the thousands of white Southerners that would have attended these reunions, especially the national reunions that took place in large cities annually. And these body servants, they played a really important role, not just in reinforcing the lost cause narrative, but in reinforcing this sort of burgeoning Jim Crow system of white supremacy. Okay. Because especially as you get to the early 20th century or the late 19th century, white Southerners are trying to reestablish white control. And so with a new generation of black Southerners now on the scene, pushing for their own political rights, it becomes really useful to have these old black men
right.
sort of symbolizing what they take to be proper behavior. They are deferential to their former masters, and they exhibit this kind of loyalty to the Confederacy. And so within this Jim Crow culture, the body servant becomes kind of a political tool to justify the lost cause and the politics of white supremacy.
And then there's this fascinating thing I found in the book, basically the pension issue is sort of comes much later in the 19th century, early 20th century. How does that work for black Confederates? And I'm putting that in air quotes.
Yeah. You know, you'll see references today on websites to so-called pensions for black Confederate soldiers. And I'm always struck by this because, you know, a lot of these documents are available through digitized, archives. And which is a blessing. I mean, on the one hand, we love the fact today that this material is now available. Quite often, of course, it becomes misinterpreted. But what I find striking is that in many cases, it's almost as if people haven't even bothered to look at the documents themselves, because what they show us is that in the five former Confederate states that issue pensions at one point or another during the post-war years, they were clearly issued to former slaves. They were not being given to black soldiers.
Right, right.
In four of the five, it's the 1920s, early 1920s. So very few end up being issued because many of these men have already died. And of course, the amount of money they were being paid was much smaller compared to what white veterans were getting from their states. Mm-hmm. But if you read the applications, some of the questions that they're asking these former body servants in a way reinforce the lost cause narrative, because the questions right. in a sense are asking them to talk about their former masters, what they did for the Confederacy. And of course, you know, these elderly men in many cases desperately need this money,
yeah.
however small it might be. And so they're perfect. And I think they clearly know what is expected of them
yeah.
in terms of how they respond. And they certainly play it up. They in a way, they sort of reinforce that lost cause narrative for their own financial benefit. But we're not talking about that many, a few thousand right, in right. total. But they are there.
And presumably the idea of a pension for a camp servant or a behind the lines member of a military movement, that's common in all armies. So it's not as if just because some people are able to apply for pensions means they were actually fighting for this Confederate cause.
Yeah, there's only, what's interesting is that there's only one state, Virginia, that has had an expansive pension system
yeah.
that actually went beyond the body servants. What's interesting is that the men who were targeted for these pensions were the body servants, which I don't think was an accident. I think it was intentional because they understood that these men had already established themselves in this sort of lost cause Confederate memory as the most loyal of the loyal slaves.
Right, 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 right. Because they go off with, they don't refuse to go off with their masters. They That's do right. go off with their masters.
And they stick around in some cases after the war to attend these reunions and other events. Right.
Well, that brings up the sort of next question I have. It's so interesting in the book how you talk about how camp slaves became Confederate soldiers between 1865 and 1920, that their status becomes, you know, changed by the lost cause culture and this and the post-war culture.
Yeah. What's fascinating to me, and I think what is surprising to a lot of people who read the book, is that throughout the post-war period into the 20th century, mm-hmm. Confederate veterans and white Southerners generally were not confused about the status of black men in the Confederate Army. I mean, they were understood as enslaved men. It's only in the 1970s that the descendants of these men, the sons of Confederate veterans, as they call themselves, turned these body servants into the black Confederate soldiers. Because of course, by the 1970s, you know, we're coming out of the civil rights movement. There is a new interpretation of the Civil War that's just beginning to sort of filter into popular culture. And that is a narrative of the war that highlights emancipation,
right,
highlights the importance of slavery to the Civil War, and more specifically, highlights the role that roughly 200,000 black Union soldiers played preserving the Union and destroying the Confederacy and slavery. And so for sons of Confederate veterans and other Confederate heritage types, they're feeling much more on the defensive by the 1970s. And so if the Union has its black soldiers that it had ignored throughout most of the 20th century,
right,
because they weren't discussed much, then we better come up with our own black Confederate soldiers to counter this new narrative. And that's where you really begin to see this emerge, mid-1970s to the late 1970s. And at first, it's just sort of the publication of, you know, stories in the SCV's own magazine, Confederate Veteran. They commission a couple books, but it's not a narrative that really makes it beyond the community of, you know, in which the SCV exists and other groups like the United Daughters of the Confederacy. It's really not until the advent of the internet and the sort of embrace of the internet that this myth really takes off, because of course we're talking now about a time where anyone can post anything about history or anything else for that matter.
That's true. Yeah.
And if you are not being taught how to search and assess online information and you don't already have a background in history, you may come across one of these websites with one of these accounts or photographs and end up believing he looks like a soldier. There must have been a couple soldiers in the Confederate Army. And there you go.
So in many, many, many ways, then this myth is a product of the 1970s, not even of the 1870s.
No, that is absolutely right. I mean, other than the fact that Northern newspapers printed accounts of black soldiers in the army, in many cases for political purposes, to convince Lincoln to start recruiting black men into the United States Army. Hey, Lincoln, the Confederacy is already doing this. If you don't step up to the plate, you're not going to have, you know, they're going to be able to take advantage of this resource. So you better get the ball rolling. And of course, we know that Lincoln did. But other than that, it's not until the 1970s that this really becomes sort of what we now know as sort of the Black Confederate myth.
And that's well within living memory. So what happens then with since the 1970s, it seems to have gotten stronger.
It has. And I think, you know, I'm a history educator. And so, of course, you know, any opportunity I get, I'm going to highlight the importance of digital media education. In other words, again, you know, sort of teaching teachers and students how to properly, you know, take advantage of the wealth of resources on the internet. But I think because there is such a lack of, or our history education does suffer in many respects, you know, it's, you know, you find this myth appearing in, you know, any number of places. And so one of the best examples is in 2009 or 10 in Virginia, a new fourth grade history textbook was issued across the state. And it just so happened that a Civil War historian at the College of William and Mary had a daughter in the fourth grade, and she decided to take a look at her textbook and to see what it says about the Civil War. And when she, of course, opened to that chapter, what was interesting is the chapter overall is pretty good. It sort of highlights slavery and emancipation. Right. But then there's this reference to a couple thousand black soldiers fighting with Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley in 1862. And so, of course, you know, news got out about this. It was all over the national news, even beyond. And when the author was asked, you know, where did you get this information? You can imagine what she, you know, how she responded. I Googled it, right? So, you know, so examples like that. I mean, this is the way in which the internet, its tentacles sort of reach into places that really do sort of highlight how important it is to you know, to educate people on how to properly use the internet. But the National Park Service has on occasion fallen for this myth. When pointed out, they've taken exhibits down, which I think speaks to their integrity. I think they do really incredible work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you find it in you know, in different places. But I think the internet is the problem, because again, it's a Wild West show, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, Google doesn't rank based on truth, right?
Yeah. Well, and it probably is exacerbated by the fact that the you know, immense spread of the internet and the 150th anniversary of the Civil War sort of happen at the same time. Yeah. So there's bound to have been a lot of talk about it anyway. And then there is this new tool, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think the people who are really actively pushing this, especially during the sesquicentennial between 2011 and 15, were feeling very defensive, because of course, you know, if you paid any attention to the sesquicentennial, in contrast to the way in which the war was commemorated in the early 1960s during the centennial, in the latter case, the service of Black Union soldiers was really the dominant narrative of that sort of 4 year plus commemoration. So I think for the Confederate heritage types, they went out of their way to highlight, you know, in any way they could, the service of these sort of so-called Black Confederates. And I think, but I think at the same time, one point I want to make is that the Black Confederate narrative, although it lives and thrives on the internet, I think in recent years, it hasn't been able to really stick, you know, beyond the internet. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, I think an example of this is the fact that the monuments are still coming down. The Confederate flags are still coming down from public spaces. And after the shootings in Charleston in 2015, those horrific shootings by Dylann Roof in Charleston, the South Carolina division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans came out and said, hey, this has nothing to do with racism and white supremacy. I don't care if Dylann Roof was holding a Confederate flag, because the Confederacy recruited Black Confederate soldiers. That was part of their official statement in the days after the murders in Charleston. But of course, it didn't work, right? I mean, those flags,
when you think about it that way, in
Columbia came down a few weeks later. Monuments and statues, you know, they're still coming down. So I think the way in which the SCV attempted to sort of use the Black Confederate narrative as a defense of their heritage and the glory of the Confederacy,
right,
it's not a winning argument right now.
Right. Okay. Well, I have to mention to our listeners, of course, that you have been, shall we say, flamed on social media, especially on Twitter and on other parts of the internet. How has that been? I mean, a lot of them are obviously ridiculous, but some of them, you know, they're these people who think they know and who have searched all this stuff, and then they say really genuinely awful things to you and about you.
Yeah. You know, I think one thing to keep in mind is, you know, I started blogging back in 2005.
That's early.
Called Civil War Memory.
Yes.
CWMemory.com. And so I've been at it for now 15 years, using social media as sort of my own, as an extension of my classroom, and as a way to sort of share my own research projects. So from the beginning, you can imagine, with a website titled Civil War Memory, I think the first blog post about Black Confederates was probably somewhere around 2008. So I've been at it for a long time, and so I haven't heard anything that I haven't heard going on 15 years. So I'm more amused by it than anything else. Obviously, it can go past what is just sort of a healthy kind of you know, negative response. But for the most part, I think it is, you know, for me, as someone who's interested in memory of history, how we remember and why in so many cases we are so wedded to our preferred narratives of the past, to me, it just sort of reinforces that. And it just, it's evidence for me, right?
Right,
I can distance myself from it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Do you ever have demonstrators or people protesting you at book signings and things like that?
That's such a good question, because, you know, the book came out in September. And, you know, I really feel for so many of my author friends right now who are
because we're all
had their book tours just basically canceled because of the virus. I mean, I enjoyed a pretty successful book tour between September. A number of my talks have been canceled, but up until February. And before the book came out, I just thought, given my past, I just thought people would be coming out of the woodwork to attend my talks.
Right, 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 right.
But I really haven't had any problems, and I've been all over the place, including parts of the Deep South. And I'll be honest, I'm almost a little disappointed. It's almost as if they've forgotten about me.
Well, but also it might be a positive thing, in the same way that the fact that the flags and the statues are still coming down is a positive thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And I think in many cases we're talking about sort of computer warriors, right? They are brave in front of the keyboard, but that's about it.
Right,
coming outside and challenging me head on is another thing entirely. Although I welcome it, you know.
Well, of course, Buzzkiller should know that links to the book are naturally available on the blog post for this website, for this episode, what we call the Buzzkill Bookshelf. But also, what we're going to do is we're going to give away a copy of Kevin Levin's Searching for Black Confederates to the first Buzzkill Patreon supporter who emails me and asks for one. So if you're interested in this topic and you are a member of our Patreon group, please email me right away, and we're going to, of course, promote this on social media, and you'll get a copy in the mail ASAP. And it just remains for me to say thank you very much for coming on. This is a wonderful show. It's a wonderful book. It's a very thought-provoking book, and it's a very thoughtful book.
I appreciate it. Any chance to talk about this subject, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Okay. All right. We'll say to the Buzzkillers that we'll talk to you next week.